Back again to Bad Quaker Podcast, where liberty is our mission. Today is Friday, December 21st, 2012. This is podcast number 252, and my name is Ben Stone. I had hoped this week, specifically today, I had hoped to have a historian on that was going to talk about World War I. We were going to continue in our series on war. And we were going to talk about World War I and the Christmas Truce. If you're not familiar with the Christmas Truce in World War I, it's I've said before, and maybe I'll change my mind at some point, but I think the Christmas Truce is, for me, the single most fascinating event in history that I'm aware of. I know there's some disclaimers I added in there, some ways out of my statement, but history, there's so much information, there's so many events to talk about, but I really think that the Christmas Truce was maybe the most fascinating event in history that I'm aware of. It was really an amazing point in time, and it was a moment where some really interesting things could have taken off and happened, but they didn't. It went the wrong way. But it's a shining moment in history that speaks volumes of the real nature of human beings. So anyway, it didn't work out. The historian that I was trying to get on the show today wasn't able to adjust his schedule in a way that we could get him back on. Hopefully, you know, I'd like to be able to record the interview over the weekend or possibly Monday or Tuesday or something. I don't know exactly how busy he's going to be. But even if I can get him on the show, even in the days after Christmas, it's still going to have the effect, whether or not we focus on the Christmas truce and whether or not it's before or after Christmas, I think is far less of the point than to get the message out of what happened and how important it was, and all the events leading up to World War I, and how World War I literally drew a new world that we live in, that didn't have to be a century of war that was completely unnecessary. You know, the rise of the fascist governments, the rise of the Soviet government, and it's just, there's so many things echo out from that one stupid event. And so even if we can't get him on Bad Quaker Podcast, before one particular day that everybody recognizes as being somehow magic, even if we can't do that, I still want to get him back on the show. He hasn't been on the show yet, but I want to get him on the show as soon as possible to take on that topic of World War I and continue the series in war. And at this point, I am planning on continuing the series out. I did one on Pearl Harbor, but I want to do a fuller one on World War II completely. And I want to at least touch on the Korean War. You know, boy, I don't know. There's so much there. I don't want to commit to doing a whole podcast on the Korean War. And also, I've skipped over, you know, the Spanish-American War, which was really very important, a lot more important than most Americans understand, I think. And so, I might not have these all in sequence, but I'd really like to step back and put one in the series on the Spanish-American War. I can't do a series on war and not do Vietnam, so I'm going to have to do something with that. And I'm already building notes for the current wars that the U.S. is in Afghanistan and Iraq. So, I don't know how long it's going to take to put all these together. It may be months before we finish them all up. But and like I'm planning on doing with this this World War I historian, I plan on having some guests in at different times in order to help out with explaining these things. And the whole point in this being, if you're not familiar with the series that I've been doing on war, the whole point is to show that the government in Washington, D.C., lies, and the wars that it has been engaged in over its history have all, every single one, been a war of aggression, a war that the United States government lied to its people in order to get them involved, a war where they falsified information and gave that both to Congress and to the American people to justify going into a war. Every single war that the Washington, D.C. government has engaged itself in has been a war of aggression that that it intentionally created and went into knowingly, and sometimes very much against the will of the people, but through the lies and manipulations, it justified going into these wars. So yeah, I want to get back with that, so that's just a little commercial there for that. But that's not our main topic today. I want to talk today about the basics of, I've talked before about this concept of liberty as a mission, as opposed to, you know, a liberty movement. And I know this is just wordplay, and maybe it doesn't really mean that much, but, you know, perceptions are so important. And a movement is a temporary thing, a fad, something that comes and goes. It's something that doesn't really have any backbone to it, any real purpose. It's just something that people play with for a while and then they move on. But a mission is something that a person is dedicated to. There's planning involved. There's execution of the mission. There's a goal. There's a certain level of dedication that you're not going to get from just a faddish movement. So today I want to talk about the fundamental basics of the mission of liberty and why it is what exactly is it that those of us who get this, and I'm talking about people like myself, people like the guys over at Freedom Fiends, people like Larkin Rose, people like Stefan Molyneux, Ernie Hancock out there in Arizona. There's a lot, it's not a small group of people. There's a lot of us that are in this mission and that are pushing it. We may not use all the same terminology. We may not, we're not sitting around planning. I've never even talked to Ernie Hancock. So we're not necessarily plotting this out and everything. And yet we can still, among us, we can still see that this one goal is there, and we're all marching on the same path, even though there's variations and there's differences among us. And so the purpose of this podcast today is to kind of define, if you're a longtime listener, a lot of this is going to be repeat material for you, but maybe I can give it in a way that's either, you know, a slightly different angle than you've seen before, or maybe it's going to be, either way, I'll at least try to make it entertaining. But what I really want to do is to lay the fundamentals down so that you can understand really what it is that we're moving towards, why we're moving towards it, who we really are. If you're not familiar with the things that I'm talking about, maybe you're new to the show or whatever, to try to focus in and understand why it is that we're doing what we're doing and what direction that we're taking and how we're different from other people out there that are using some of the same terminology and the same, you know, phrases and catchwords and buzzwords and, you know, throwing Ron Paul's name around and throwing the name libertarian around and all these other things like this. How are we different from these other people? Now, if you were listening yesterday, I had David McElroy on, and he said something that I just can't let this pass by. He said that we're not like everyone else. He said we're oddballs, we're weirdos, we're freaks. We'll never be the majority. And he also said that we just don't think like they do. And all this is true. But I thought at the time, and I couldn't really take David off on a side rant because I only had a limited time with him. But I thought at the time, this could be scary to some people. This could be people who have thought in the past, well, you know, what we need to do is we need to get people elected into these positions, and then we need to try to influence this party or influence that party, or we need to try to, you know, move into at least into these lower levels of politics and try to win the hearts of these people, or try to show that our policies are better than their policies. Or, you know, well, no. All of that is counterproductive. Every bit of those things is counterproductive. What I want to express to you today is that, yes, we are the oddballs. We are the freaks and the weirdos, and we will never be the majority, and we don't have to be the majority. And that's not a losing prospect. This is not, it is not necessary for us to ever win the majority over to our side. This is just, it's not practical. It's not necessary. You don't need to go, that's not the goal, and you don't need to put effort in that direction. As a matter of fact, effort put in that direction is wasted energy. And there are much better ways. I hope to show you this today. There are much better ways that you can spend your time and your money and your effort and your resources of all kinds to try to push this this mission of liberty without wasting your time giving money to some politician or hoping to push government in one direction or other, or begging government for a little bit more soup. That's my goal today, is to lay down the fundamentals of who we are, what we're pushing towards, and what sets us apart. Okay, so now, so it is true. It is absolutely true. We're the oddballs. We will never be the majority. And we should be happy about this. We should be thrilled that we are what we are. I see this phrase on the internet pretty frequently, especially back before the last election. I saw this phrase, and it's kind of cute. I thought it was funny, and I enjoy seeing it. It has some irony in it. But the phrase, and these were all over memes and all over the internet and everything, but the phrase is, libertarians want to take over and leave you alone. And that's kind of funny. It's neat. It's catchy. But no, it's wrong. It is absolutely wrong. The whole point of being a libertarian is to not take over. Yeah, leave you alone, that's what libertarians want, sure. But the idea that a libertarian can take over is an oxymoron. It's self-contradictory. Okay, so no, we don't want to take over. We shouldn't. If you want to take over, you're missing the point of being a libertarian. You're missing the point of libertarianism entirely. We do not want to take over. So we have these phrases that keep getting thrown around, like take over. We have, we want to win the hearts and minds. We want to fix government. We want to streamline government. We want to bring liberty. We want to minimize government. We want a minimum government. We want to maximize freedom. Well, what that really, maximize freedom? Maximize freedom. Think about that for a minute. Something is either free or it's not. Now, my regular rant on this involves a bird in a cage. You have a bird and you have a cage. If the bird is inside the cage, the bird is not free. The size of the cage is irrelevant. If you have a bird in a cage, the bird is not free. It is either free or it is not. The existence of the cage with the bird inside guarantees that the bird is not free. It doesn't even matter if the bird can perceive the cage. If the bird is in the cage, it is not free. It can't be kind of free or mostly free or partially free or more free today than yesterday or less free. It is either captive or it is free. Now, liberty is the action of moving towards freedom. So liberty can be in degrees. We can have more or less liberty, and we are we are utilizing the liberties that we have in order to try to obtain freedom. But you are either free or you're not. If you look at your dog, is the dog on the leash? Then the dog is not free. Well, what if you have a 5-foot leash instead of a 3-foot leash? The dog is not free. What if it's a 10-foot leash? The dog is not free. The dog is either free or it is not. If it is on a leash, it is not free. Okay, so we can't have degrees of freedom. You can't maximize freedom. You're either free or you're not. Okay, so then we look over. I went over to the Libertarian Party's website because I haven't been over there in a long time. And, because it's painful, this thing that's being sold to the public as libertarian with this label of Libertarian Party, it just really saddens me, you know. So I look over there on their website, and they have solutions. They have a whole subsection on their website for solutions. And as you start to go through, and they have a whole series of videos, of short videos, of different Libertarian Party candidates explaining what their solutions are. It doesn't really say what the problem is, other than government. But then the solution they're offering you is government. So, you know, I'm not really sure I understand exactly how they justify this to themselves. But basically, if you really look at what the Libertarian Party is offering, what they're saying is there's problems with the left-right, with the Democrat-Republican type of government. So trust us with the ring of power. You can't trust Saron. You can't trust that guy over there. You can't trust this horrible politician. You can't trust those bad guys. But you can trust me. Now, why would we trust the Libertarian Party or some specific libertarian with the power that Obama wields? Why would we think, oh, well, you know, this guy, this politician, this guy who's been a politician, you know, almost his whole life, or this guy who wants desperately to be a lifetime politician, is somehow going to behave differently than this other lifetime politician or this other guy who wants to be a lifetime politician? You see, if someone desires to be some kind of a position in government that controls government, then there's a flaw right there, and that should be a red flag that says something's wrong, and I don't want anything to do with that. So no, I don't trust the Libertarian Party with the ring of power any more than I trust the Republicans or the Democrats, especially when it seems to me like pretty much every prominent libertarian just the other day was a Republican. Doesn't that seem odd to anybody else? So what are they saying over there at the Libertarian Party? Well, they want to eliminate, one of the politicians says he wants to eliminate the Department of Education. Well, that's an old conservative talking point. That's not libertarian. That's a half measure at best, and it misses the entire point of the government forcing children to be indoctrinated in government schools. That's the problem. The problem is not whether it comes from the federal level or the state level or the local level or whatever. Forced indoctrination with state propaganda is a bad idea. This is slavery. When you're basically throwing children in jail for 12 years for a crime they didn't commit, and dumping indoctrination on them the whole time. So when you say you want to eliminate the Department of Education, you're not addressing the problem. You're missing the point entirely. Another one of these politicians at the LP says they want to cut the number of overseas bases in half, and this will save the government money. Why? Why do you want to do that? So the government can live longer, grow bigger, and grow stronger, and beat us up here at home instead of beating up somebody in some foreign country? Because somehow drawing all that, because somehow cutting the budget for the government and giving them more money to spend on what? On the war on drugs? Meddling more in the U.S. affairs? Is that what we want government to do? Is it really just all we have to do is just, you know, have a more efficient government and everybody will be happy? Do you really believe that? Then you're missing the point. Another one says they want to cut property taxes by 25%. Now, as soon as I heard this politician say this on the Libertarian Party's website, my first impression, or the first thought that I had, was of the little boy in that one story where he's in the orphanage and he goes up to the person handing out the soup to all the other poor children, and he says, "Can I have some more, please?" And she whacks him on the head with a spoon. Now, that's exactly what I thought of when I saw this libertarian politician asking for more soup. Can we cut property taxes by 25%? By what right does the government take property taxes? By what right does the government say your property does not belong to you? You must pay me for you to live on that property. You spend $100,000, $200,000, $500,000 on property, and then you don't own it. The government can take it at any point just because you don't pay your quit rent. That's not libertarian. 25% cut is not libertarian. A compromise like that. Please, can I have some more? How about this other one? They want to lighten the alcohol laws in Utah. Just give me a little bit longer leash and I'll be happy, right? Another one is talking about busting the electric monopolies. And then they actually compare it to the airlines and how the airlines were freed up from the monopolies. And now you can start your own airlines. Really? You can? You can't even start your own taxi service, much less your own airline. Now that's just lies and fantasy and mythology. That's what the Libertarian Party is offering. And so if you think that I'm kind of being harsh today, it's because sometimes castles made of sand need to be washed away. When I get back from the break, I'm going to present something that maybe you'll find a little bit more acceptable than just begging your master for more soup.
Admit it, you hate shopping for Christmas. You do. It's a hassle coupled with a burden, mechanically checking off friends, relatives, and coworkers from your list. You're probably not even religious, but if you are, is buying your cousin some little made-in-China piece of plastic really celebrating the birth of your savior? This holiday season, why buy gifts for friends and relatives? Most of them are status anyway. You should send that money to the Freedom Fiends instead. The Freedom Fiends will use your money to help spread education of horizontal liberation throughout the world. If you want to help provide inoculation from indoctrination, go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post to send your money to the fiends instead. Because buying crap for unappreciative statist relatives won't get your name on the golden floppy disk of redemption. And if you must shop for Christmas, please do it through the Freedom Fiends Amazon link over on the right side of freedomfiends.com. It won't cost you anything extra, and Amazon will save you the danger of holiday drive-by stabbings at your local mall. Amazon pretty much sells everything you can buy on this earth, except for guns and weed. But they do sell the DVD Guns and Weed: The Road to Freedom, so get that for your gun-hating stoner brother or neocon gun nut dad. They'll thank you for it. That's freedomfiends.com.
Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the break. So now, in the first part of the podcast there, I was trying to make the point that just merely begging for more soup from the master is not going to solve the problem. And it's not really even very libertarian to just say, if we could just make the burden of government just slightly lighter, then we'll be okay. All we have to do is, if we could just have a few extra rations for the galley slaves, and while we're doing that, we'll just deny the fact that they actually are galley slaves. You see, the denial, the lies that go with government, and the denial that government is anything other than aggressive monster that feeds off of the rest of us. That's not productive. It doesn't push us towards freedom, and it is not utilizing the liberties that we have in the most efficient method possible in order to obtain freedom. So now, how do we have a peaceful mind and still understand that we're the freaks, we're the weirdos, and we're never, ever, ever going to become the majority because people just don't think like us? The majority of people don't think like us. So how can you accept that and still have a peaceful mind? Well, that's what this segment of the podcast is going to focus on. How can you have a peaceful mind and be comfortable in the thought that we are the weirdos and that we will always be the minority? We will never gain a complete majority and take over and make things the way we want. So how can we have that peace of mind then? Well, step one is to reject all thoughts whose roots feed on the poison of democracy. You have to understand that democracy is a combination of lies and deceit and theft. The very idea that you can have a majority and then inflict upon the minority the will of that majority, and that somehow that will be good. That core thought has to be rejected before you can move on to anything near the thoughts of liberty and understanding libertarianism. So now I want to define a couple words here because I think it's important. We don't want to drive people away based on misunderstanding of a couple of words. So it's really important that I define a couple of words here. Take apart the word democracy, demo, D-E-M-O, and then C-R-A-C-Y. This literally is Greek. It literally means people ruled or ruled by the authority of the people. All right. Now, let's take a word like anarchy. Forget what government schools told you. Forget what government-backed, mainstream media teaches you. Forget all those things. The word anarchy means self-ordered or self-organized. Now, I know that people say, well, it means against law or against authority. No, it doesn't. It's anarchy. A-N, like the prefix would be A-N-I. Anarchy, not anti-archy. Anarchy, like animated. So it means self. It doesn't mean against. Against would be anti, like anti-establishment or anti-aircraft or anti-something else. But it's not anti. It's not anti-archy. It's anarchy. Self-ordered. Now we say, archy, okay, that's law, right? Archy, that's law. No, that's not law. And it's not rule. Remember, democracy is people ruled. So anarchy is not rule, it's not self-ruled, it means self-ordered. Like hierarchy uses the word archy. And a hierarchy means an ascending order. So you can have a set of files that have a hierarchy in their order. That doesn't mean that there are laws that some cop comes and hits you on the head if you don't put your files in the right order. That means that if you have your files organized in a hierarchy, then the least important ones are here and the most important ones are there, and then you meter out where the others go in relationship to those two. So that's how a hierarchy works. It doesn't infer laws and it doesn't infer government. It means ordered. So anarchy is self-ordered. And this is really important if you understand, if someone wants to make the argument with you, well, it's just a way of pronouncing it, or when so-and-so first used this word in 18-something or whatever, it's all beside the point. It's all water under the bridge. The word right now today, and if you talk to anarchists who are actually philosophical anarchists, we're not people who are out there trying to burn things and set property on fire or smash windows. And none of those things are consistent with anarchy. Because if you're breaking somebody's windows or setting a trash can on fire, you're not being self-ordered. You're not managing yourself. You're letting a mob manage you. So again, it's not anti-archy. Dropping the T, which is a consonant, changes the entire meaning of the prefix, and it goes from being against to being self. So it's two separate, different concepts there. So democracy means people ruled, but anarchy means self-ordered. Now, the heart of the problem with democracy is this belief that a majority has any moral significance. When you accept this in your mind, you have accepted an absolute blasphemy. A blasphemy, whether you're religious or not, if you're religious, it is a blasphemy to God to believe that the majority can set morals. And if you don't believe in God, if an atheist, or if you're agnostic, or if you're however you classify yourself, if you believe that the majority can make up morals, then that's still a blasphemy against humanity. It's a blasphemy against you as an individual, because it means that literally a gang of 20 or 30 people could just decide that, hey, it's moral if we bust into your house and take your stuff, and if you resist, we'll kill you. Well, is that moral? Well, if you believe in the heart of democracy, then yes. You would have to believe that if a gang of 20 people, because you're one and they're 20, they have the moral right. See, if you believe democracy, you have to accept that, because there's no logical way out of that. And you say, well, what if it's bigger numbers? What if it's all the way out to the whole public? How about we have this whole idea that millions of people decide what it is? Well, there's a problem with that. You know, millions of people don't run governments. If you take all the governments in the world, everybody who's in charge of all governments in the world, they all add up to about 6,000 people. 6,000 people, if we set aside all the foil hat, all the conspiracy theories, if you set aside all that stuff, about 6,000 people rule the world of about 7 billion human beings. That's not democracy. That's not even the hint of democracy. That is a lie and a myth telling you that democracy is possible, telling you that there's some kind of social contract. It is not. It is 6,000 people making up the rules and inflicting them upon the 7 billion. That is not democracy. But even if it could, even if you could get 6,999,999 whatever, if you could get them all to agree that what is moral is for them to kill you, would that make it moral? Of course not. The concept is ridiculous. So in its heart, the very core of democracy, the idea that a majority can somehow come up with a moral or a moral standard or even one single law, that should be anathema to every single human being. Good and evil cannot be based on public opinion. Good and evil have to have something else to justify what is good and what is evil. It can't just be based on the whims of public opinion, and it certainly can't be based on a tiny little minority that runs the government and that controls all the monopolies of authority in the world. Remember, the majority has no more moral right to lead than someone claiming the divine right of kings. How would they have any more of a moral right than just some wacko claiming the divine right of kings? The majority can only rule by aggressing on the minority. Let's even assume, forget about the 6,000 ruling the world for a minute. In this fantasy world where the majority actually could rule, the majority could only rule by aggressing on the minority. And ultimately, each and every one of us, each individual, at some point is the minority. So democracy on earth is a blend of myths and lies. And the idea, the myth that the majority can set morals somehow, and the lies that government could ever represent the majority. These are the myths and lies that democracy is based on. This is really utopian to believe things like this, to believe that somehow the will of the majority could be represented by this tiny body of rulers, and that somehow the decisions of the majority could somehow produce morality. I think today most people, I mentioned the divine right of kings a second ago, I think today most people reject the divine right of kings. Now, why is that? Why don't we still believe that kings, you know, the word of the king is the word of God? Why don't we believe that anymore? Why did we reject that? Well, it's because it was a myth, and it's been completely discredited. As humans, we've outgrown it. But democracy has been sold to the masses as the moral solution to justify the aggression of the state. Democracy has become the placebo that replaced this concept of divine right of kings. And the divine right of kings was the placebo that replaced the divinity of kings. Now, what I mean here, I want to draw a line between the divine right of kings and the divinity of kings, because at one point, and in some places not that long ago, the king himself or emperor or whatever was thought to actually be a god. And then it changed, let's go through a series here. The government schools continually lie about the origin of the state, and the government apologists, the government court historians, they continually lie about the origin of the state. So let's get to the origin really quick, and longtime listeners have gone through all this before, so I'm not going to go into it real heavy. One of these days I'll do another whole series on Jericho and we'll get into that, but I'm not going to put a lot of effort on it today. But the very first example that we know absolutely for sure of the existence of the state was in the city-state of Jericho about 11,000 years ago. Now, we know this because there was a skirt wall and a tower, And the very first example, Jericho is a slight rocky mound or an outcropping in the Jordan Valley. And so about 11,000 years ago, we know that a group of people encamped on that rocky mound and fortified it with a skirt wall and a tower. Now, archaeology has shown us this in dating methods and all this kind of thing. So from and then it was about another 2,000 or 3,000 years before the very next city-state appeared, and that was in the neighboring valley of in the Mesopotamian region. So the very first state in Jericho existed for a couple thousand years before the second one existed. And this tiny tower, we know that this was the birth of the state because this tiny tower and this little skirt wall could only contain a few dozen people at best. It could not protect the whole residents of the valley. So it's obvious that the encampment on Jericho was meant to protect the elite from the residents of the valley. And so we have all the evidence there of the state. We have taxation. We have the overproduction of grain, monocropping. We have the garrison on Jericho. We have every aspect to show that the state actually did exist there, completely on its own, completely without any threat of any exterior state. The only threat to the state at Jericho, at the mound in Jericho, was the residents of the valley of the Jordan, if they didn't want to be taxed, if they wanted to reject their leaders. And I've gone before and shown how the mythology was created to justify these robbers, this robber's roost in Jericho. And what actually took place was that a mythology. Well, there was this religion of the shepherd god. And he was often worshipped in caves or on tops of mountains, and there would be altars or there would be different worshipping areas for this shepherd god. So these thieves in Jericho were able to usurp this mythology of the shepherd god, and they eventually made him into a god of you know, food and eventually bread and specifically grains and so forth. And grain was the handy thing because you could tax grain. You can't tax, it's much more difficult to tax other commodities of the time, but you could tax grain. So the state was born in Jericho when these robbers, these thieves, were able to convince the neighboring valley that they were the priests of this shepherd god that they converted into a god of bread. And now, so we have this group of priests on this temple mound, and they're worshiping this god, and they're requiring a tax, an offering from the valley to appease this god and make sure that the weather is good and the harvest is good and all these things. And the state, of course, is offering protection, but protection from who? There was no other states. So thieves oftentimes will offer you protection from other thieves if you pay them enough. And they often do this without your approval, without you voluntarily being a part of it. I mean, that's what mafias do. That's what gangs have done throughout history. And that's exactly what was taking place in Jericho. And that's exactly what governments are. They're just an organized mob of thieves that promise us protection, but we don't really have a choice in the matter. So to run down the list here, as it happened in Jericho and as it happened in every other place where the state appeared, you start out with thieves, robbers, and they eventually develop a robber's roost and fortify it. And then they develop the myth of the thieves as priests appointed by God to rule. And then, the old saying is that scum rises to the top. So among the thieves, some one will be stronger than the others, and there will develop a natural leader among the thieves. And so he becomes king. Well, the myth has to shift slightly. So oftentimes that king is then recognized as a god. In other words, so the priests are no longer recognizing the old god. Now they've got a new god. And so the king becomes God. Now, eventually, this king dies. Maybe you can convince the next generation that the next king is God too. But it's a little, at some point in time, it becomes a little hard to support this story, especially when the son is less than the father. So then you have the story. Well, he's the son of the old king. Therefore, he's the son of a god, and therefore, you know, he can perpetuate this rule. Well, eventually, the king is a descendant of the god. He's not the god, but he's a descendant of the god. And so eventually, that story falls apart. And so now we say, well, the king is appointed by God. And that's where you get to the divine right of kings. The king himself is no longer a divinity. The king has lost his divinity. But you still have the divine right of the king because he's appointed by God. Now, when I get back from this break, we'll keep going in the descent of how this turns into tyranny, even without a king. I'll be right back. Did you know author Taryn P. Lupo has a new novel out called One Nation Under Blood? When a rejuvenative blood technology is developed that pits the young against the old, the government must take firm steps to address the war of supply and demand brewing across generational lines. Blood is not the only thing bought and sold in this dystopian tale of technology, economics, and independence. Vampires are now very real, but we never expected them to wear our grandmother's best Sunday dress. The Bad Quaker staff has discovered how easy it is to get everything you need for the holidays at Amazon. Everything from the coolest decorations to hangover remedies, and everything from the latest movies and music to poop stain remover. If you follow the Amazon link at badquaker.com, Amazon will give badquaker.com a tiny portion of the purchase. It won't cost you any extra, but you will be supporting this podcast. Thank you. Okay, thanks for sticking with me. So I was talking about how we go from, you know, the king as God to the king as appointed by God. Well, at some point in history, and in the case of English history, this took place about the time of the signing of the Magna Carta. But at some point in history, it becomes obvious that the king holds his power essentially because he has surrounded himself with people with power. So in the case of England, around the time of the signing of the Magna Carta, you had something introduced called common consent. And you see this mentioned quite often about that time frame in English history. But you have to keep in mind, this is not, when we say common consent, we weren't talking about the commoners. We were talking about the common consent of the other lords. You see, in England, the king was just one of the lords. He wasn't necessarily appointed by God or descended from God. He was just the most successful of the thieves. So then it evolved, especially in English history, it evolved to the point where there was a parliament. Okay, well, parliament comes from the French word to parler, which means to speak. But in this case, the use of the word parliament didn't mean to speak or to talk. It meant to come to a conclusion, to decide. So the parliament, George W. Bush would have loved this concept. The parliament was the deciders, see. And again, this is, even though this has the hints of democracy, it's all a lie. First off, the parliament has no natural right to decide what a law is, or to inflict a law, or to have any decision about the process. And they certainly, even though they lie and they say they represent the people, they are not the people. You can't have the will of the people represented by a small pocket of people, because how can they be? They can't know what the mind of all those people are. Unless you magically believe that these parliamentarians are somehow above or better than the rest of all of humanity. And that's where the myth really starts to fall apart. So once they've accepted this common consent, and once that's moved on to become a parliament, then this idea of democracy starts to come in. And the idea of having this king appointed by God, the story's full of holes to begin with, but then it really falls away. But now you have this myth of democracy. Now all of a sudden the people are ruling. Well, they're not really. It's still just a small committee of humans telling everybody else what to do. So every step in this process is a faith-based assumption that the state is good. Every step in this process is a religious justification for a small group of humans to aggress on the rest of humanity and to live off of our sweat and off of our toil. All of this, this whole process is nothing more than a religion. And it's not Islam, and it's not Christianity, and it's not Judaism, and it's not any other of that kind of religion. It's a far more powerful religion that grasps people's minds, and they don't even know they believe it, and yet they're dedicated to it. Now, at this point, my regular listeners hear this all the time, but I want to point this out because we've had a lot of growth in the podcast in the last few months. Well, actually, almost every month we've been growing since the podcast began. But anyway, so I want to differentiate between government and state. Government, when a lot of people use these words interchangeably, and I would, you know, if I had a better word to use than state, I would use it. If there was some way to come up with a new word and for people to be able to understand it, I would happily abandon what I'm about to say and adopt this new word. But we don't have a new word, so I'm stuck with the definitions that we have. So I see when I talk about the government, I see the government as being all those people that wear costumes and inflict upon us, all the rules and the laws and all that stuff. Those people are the government. But the state is the concept, the faith in people's minds that tells them that government is legitimate. And the echo out from this, the waves that perpetuate out from that core belief, that this belief that some human beings have the right to lord upon other human beings, to place their will upon other human beings, and to live off the sweat of other human beings. The idea that that is right and good, that's the state. And once you adopt the state, the things that ripple out away from that become the idea that the government can authorize corporations, and those corporations can be, in many ways, have the same rights as human beings, even though there's no single person that owns and controls it. And in many ways, those corporations are exempt from the regular rules that you and I live by. Just like government, people in government are, to a large part, exempt from the rules that the rest of us have to live by. It's okay for the cop to walk down the street with any number of weapons that the regular mundanes like us are not allowed to walk around with. It's okay for a judge, a so-called judge, to sit in a court and give his judgment, and then the cops go out and enforce that judgment. But what if you tried that? You see, so government exists by laws that don't apply to the rest of us, and the laws that the government puts down upon us, it itself doesn't have to live by. And so it's done the same thing with corporations, and the same thing with central banking, and the same thing with the mass media. You know, the media exists as an aspect of the state, of this bigger mythology, and they supply the lies that support all this whole mythology. So when we talk about the government, we're talking about one aspect of the state, one aspect of this greater myth of the state. Okay, now, I want to point this out, because whether we're talking about an atheist or a theist or anywhere in between or any side branches of that, if you believe this myth that the government is justified in behaving the way that it behaves, if you believe this myth that it's okay for corporations to do stuff that regular people can't do, if you believe this myth that a corporation has the rights of a human being, if you believe all these lies that come to us from the mythology of the state, whether you call yourself an atheist or a theist or a Christian or a Muslim or whatever you call yourself, you are actually believing the religion of the state. You have adopted and are a defender of the faith in your God, the state. And that might be offensive, but if you really think about it, it's the truth. The state is a religion. The state has priests. The state has its tithes, its required offerings. The state allows prayer. You can petition the government. How do you petition the government? Well, you can write a letter to your congressman. You can go and vote. You can, a vote is an individual petition to government. Well, that's what prayer is. Prayer is to petition your God. When you petition your God in prayer, that's the same as when you petition your government with your vote, or when you petition a politician with a letter to him saying, please, please, can I have more soup? Please, can you not tax me so badly? Please, can I carry some types of muted weapons to defend myself with? Please, can I have your permission to carry a weapon? If you're doing that, if you're doing any of those things, you are petitioning your God with prayer. So then, if we can't trust in the government, and we can't trust in democracy to tell us what is good and what is bad and what is right and what is wrong, then what can we fall back upon? What really are our morals based on? Are our morals based upon what a bunch of people say? Are our morals based upon what a committee says, what central planning tells us? Is that what our morals are based on? Because if they are, then you've got morals based on something that is changeable and flexible and is based on what other people can get from you. So we have to introduce, in order to find this, in order to find how do we develop and discover morals, first we have to address the question of aggression. Can aggression ever be moral? Now, real quick, let me just define aggression, because there's a lot of confusion about this. Aggression is the initiation of violence. Violence is not aggression. You can have violence with no aggression. You can have many instances of where things can be violent and not aggressive. But aggression is the initiation of violence. Specifically, any unsolicited actions that physically affect a person or their property, no matter if the result of those actions is damaging, beneficial, or neutral to the owner. Now, let me give you an example. What if we lived in a world where fashion designers ruled everything? Fashion designers were the head of state of every government, and they decided all the laws. And the fashion designers put out the fashion police, and they would go marching through neighborhoods. And when they would find somebody who was dressed in unfashionable clothing, they would grab that person, throw them into a van, strip them naked, and put fashionable clothing upon them. Okay, now what if we lived in a world like that? Well, let's just play this out a little further. So the people grab this person, drag him into a van, put fashionable clothing upon him, and then kick him out of the van. And what's the next thing that happens? Well, somebody looks at him and says, "Wow, you're a sharp-dressed guy. I need to hire you." And they give him a better job than he had before. Well, does that justify the aggression of snatching him up and handling him that way and stripping him and forcibly putting their clothes upon him? No, it doesn't matter what the end result is. The aggression is illegitimate, no matter its purpose, no matter its intent, no matter its result. The aggression is illegitimate. And so as we pursue what is right and what is wrong, there is one easy standard. Did aggression take place? Does aggression have to take place to support this? If this thing, whatever it is, whatever you're judging, if it must have aggression to support itself, then it is immoral. And this is whether we want to call this the zero aggression principle or the non-aggression principle or the non-aggression axiom or any of the other terminology that's been placed upon it. When we understand that aggression is wrong, the initiation of violence is wrong, whether I do it or whether you do it or whether someone does it in a costume, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if 10 people vote and 11th person acting on the behalf of the 10 comes to you and does anything that's aggressive, it's still immoral. A democracy or a vote or authority from a king, nothing else can make that anything other than an act of immorality. And so then we have to understand that every single act of government is based on aggression. Every penny that they have is stolen money that they have taken from the productive. You know, I talk pretty regularly about Franz Oppenheimer, and he says there's two ways, or he said, he's gone now, but he said there's two methods that a person satisfies their wants and needs. And one method is that you work and trade, you use the sweat of your own brow, and you you create and you know, you create wealth, you grow things, you work and you do things for yourself, and then you freely exchange those things with other people, and in doing so you get what you want and they get what they want. That's one method. That's what he calls the economic means. And then there's the other method. The other method is you take what someone else has done. You take the labor of someone else. You take what belongs to someone else. And he called that the political method or the political means. Now, there's only these two methods. You either do it for yourself and then you freely exchange with someone else, and you, and through voluntary exchange, you obtain what you want. That's one way. Or you steal it. There's really only those two ways. And all government is based on the theft of the sweat and of the labor of those productive people who are actually doing something good for the economy. So then all government, as we know it today, all government is evil. And so immediately this starts to bring up objections in your mind. You say, well, you know, what about this or what about that? What? How will we do this? How will we have all these practical objections always come up? How would we have roads? How would we have justice? How would we protect ourselves from foreign aggressors? And they always say, well, you're just dreaming of a utopia. Well, remember, the utopia is the idea that a democracy is good and that a democracy actually represents the majority of people. That's what a utopia is. What I'm talking about is bringing out practical solutions to problems that don't start with aggression. Practical solutions to problems. But you can't get your mind thinking about solutions for problems if you always default back to the solution being government, being aggression. Well, if what if we need roads? Well, if you need roads, then the people, if there is a market desire, if there's a market demand for roads, then someone will respond to that market demand for roads, and that demand will be met. That's how the market works. The interference of government into that market doesn't make it better. It only makes it cost more and makes the quality of the roads go down. So one time I was talking to somebody and they said, well, we wouldn't have the advanced computers that we have now without the government. And it's funny because that's probably the weakest argument. You know, governments controlled all the technology, all of computer technology for years and wouldn't let any of it out. And it was only through underground groups in the late 60s and early 70s, underground groups literally, in many cases against the law, getting together and making homemade computers, that the computer revolution took place. If it weren't for that, computers would still take up whole buildings and have file cards. So, you know, so you don't have to have the government. All these things are just pacifiers that the government has given to people to fool them into believing that they actually need the government, when in reality the government does not supply any of these things. It's just like a pacifier given to a child. They, you know, they suck on it, but it never produces anything for them, but they believe in it anyway. And if you try to take that pacifier away from a child, then they get very upset because they think you're taking something from them. But really, that pacifier is giving them nothing. It's interfering in their process of realizing how hungry they are. And that's all that these other excuses are. So the answers do exist. Where would we have roads? How would we have computers? Who would control? How would there be justice? Who would protect us from the evil, you know, monsters in other countries that are different from us? There are answers to all these questions, but you can't find those answers until you first let go of the mythology that the state is the answer. And unless you let go of that mythology first, then you can never grasp what's beyond it. Okay, folks, thank you very much for listening today. And get over to badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission. Thank you very much.